Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen. Thank you for joining me to listen to KHOI's celebration of Memorial Day. Many of the towns in our listening area have Memorial Day parades this morning, honoring the men and women who died while serving in the U.S. military. Originally known as Decoration Day, this holiday, the last Monday of May, began its celebration nationally in the years following the Civil War and only became an official federal holiday in 1971. While it is important to honor the war dead on Memorial Day, the broader purpose of Decoration Day was a time to visit cemeteries and decorate the graves of loved ones. And in the last Monday of May, it was a time when there were plenty of garden flowers to carry out and put on the graves. It was then that communities came together to visit local cemeteries where family members were buried. Here at KHOI this Memorial Day has a special meaning. One of the most dedicated and beloved radio host, B.J. Kearns, known to her listeners as Elizabeth, died on Thursday, May 25th. Please listen to our tribute to her in the last part of this program. There will be a mass at St. Cecilia's on Wednesday, May 31st at 2 o'clock. Prior to that, there will be a visitation from 1 to 2 for those who would like to come and visit with others about their memories of B.J. Kearns. Let's listen in on a conversation with Marcia Miller about her memories of cemetery visits as a child, and more recently, Memorial Day at the Maxwell Cemetery.
Every year we'd pick up my grandmothers and we'd all go out to the cemeteries, and sometimes we'd even have a picnic.
I suppose the reason that's changed is that so few people have graves nearby.
Well, my family graves are in Ottumwa. We could go there, but it's too far. Unfortunately, we do have a grave nearby. We lost our son 4 years ago. He lived in Maxwell. His in-laws had given them land on their farm to build a home. So he actually lived right across the road from the Maxwell Cemetery. And he took care of it. He mowed it. So when he became ill and it became obvious that he probably was going to die, he wanted to be buried there. And we go out there because of that. And he also was a Story County Deputy Sheriff, so people out there know him. And it's very pleasant for us to be with all the – a lot of people come. It's quite a busy time. And aside from all of the usual veterans things, which they also have, they have music. We had a guitar player and a singer, and they have food. We have coffee and donuts, and then we just all sort of gather, and a lot of people talk about Mike because they knew him as a deputy, and I think it's kind of like a misery loves company gathering of relatives and friends.
Well, it's like a memorial service often is like a family reunion. You see
yes.
people you haven't seen for a long time. You have memories of the person that make you cry but also feel
right.
a little warm.
Yeah.
Often a little humor.
Yes, right.
Yes.
Right. And it's a beautiful little country cemetery. When we took our rabbi out there, he said it's like a Grant Wood painting.
This is KHOI Community Radio. And you have just heard from Marcia Miller talking about her personal experience of Memorial Day. Gail Seiler brings us to our next segment, where we explore connections between the living and those who have passed on, and how those connections differ across cultures and between people of different ages.
This is Gail Seiler, one of the Local Talk producers. I lived in Colombia, South America for 2 years back in the 90s. It was a common occurrence there to spend Sunday afternoon at the cemetery with relatives who had passed away. Whole families would travel to the grave of their grandparents or other family members, where they would spread a blanket or open lawn chairs, have a meal, talk to the deceased, tend the greenery, and children would play atop the grave. It struck me as a lovely way to spend time with a beloved relative who is no longer with you. This is something that sadly we don't do in the U.S., and in many cases we can't do because we've moved away. Thinking about deceased family members as still being with us and spending time with them led Kay Puttick, my colleague at KHOI, to point me to a Wordsworth poem called We Are Seven. The poem tells the story of a man talking to a young girl about her family. Though two of her siblings are dead and only four are alive, the girl insists that she and her brothers and sisters are seven in total. The man she is talking to protests because to him there are only five. He thinks that the dead don't count, but to the girl they still count. In the poem we see that the girl and the man think about death differently. Let's listen to a recording of We Are Seven.
We Are Seven by William Wordsworth. A simple child, dear brother Jim, that lightly draws its breath and feels its life in every limb, what should it know of death? I met a little cottage girl. She was 8 years old, she said. Her hair was thick with many a curl and clustered round her head. She had a rustic woodland air, and she was wildly clad. Her eyes were fair and very fair. Her beauty made me glad. Sisters and brothers, little maid, how many may you be? How many? Seven in all, she said, and wondering, looked at me. And where are they, I pray you tell? She answered, seven are we, and two of us in Conway dwell, and two are gone to sea. Two of us in the churchyard lie, my sister and my brother, and in the churchyard cottage I dwell near them with my mother. You say that two at Conway dwell, and two are gone to sea, yet you are seven. I pray you tell, sweet maid, how can this be? Then did the little maid reply, seven boys and girls are we, two of us in the churchyard lie, beneath the churchyard tree. You run about, my little maid, and your limbs they are alive. If two are in the churchyard laid, then ye are only five. Their graves are green, they may be seen, the little maid replied, 12 steps or more from my mother's door, and they are side by side. My stockings there I often knit, my kerchief there I hem, and there upon the ground I sit and sing to them. And often, after sunset, sir, when it is light and fair, I take my little porringer and eat my supper there. The first that died was little Jane. In bed she moaning lay, till God released her of her pain, and then she went away. So in the churchyard she was laid, and all the summer dry, together round her grave we played, my brother John and I. And when the ground was white with snow, and I could run and slide, my brother John was forced to go, and he lies by her side. How many are you then, said I, if they are two in heaven? The little maiden did reply, O master, we are seven. But they are dead, those two are dead, their spirits are in heaven. 'Twas throwing words away, for still the little maid would have her will, and said, Nay, we are seven.
That was William Wordsworth's poem called We Are Seven. My family members are nearly all buried in a cemetery in New Jersey, which I rarely have the opportunity to visit now. However, during a recent trip in which I passed through Newark Airport and had to change planes there, I noticed that you can see a bit of the cemetery where my relatives are buried from the windows of a certain gate area at the airport. It's not nearly as good as spending an afternoon at their graves or having them buried just outside my door, as in the poem we just heard. But it was, for me, a small reconnection to them as I passed through the area in the airport. But this got me wondering about connections to the dead and how they're maintained in other cultures. So I interviewed Hilda McCory, who is a doctoral student in the School of Education at ISU and is from Kenya.
In Kenya, we have like 42 tribes. So I'm going to talk about one tribe, and every tribe has their own culture. The culture I'm going to talk about today is the Kisii or the Gusii people, about how they treat their dead loved ones and their burial sites and what that means to them. When people die, they are buried at home. It's been a tradition for so long that the people get buried outside their houses. And it's unique that men and women are buried in different positions of the home. So a man will be buried on the right side in front of the house, then a wife or a woman will be buried on the left side. After they die, they have at least an overnight stay at home. It's a belief that they are paying their final respects to their houses. So it's good. It's like you are spending the last day on earth in your house. Then the man is laid or stays overnight in the living room, and the lady stays in the kitchen area or dining room. So when they go out, they use two different doors. So the man uses the door that's on the right side, and the woman uses the door that's on the left side of the house. When they are taken out, they know that they have to have a right side door and a left side door. Loved ones who die in cities, they are brought back home. It's believing that if you bury them somewhere else outside, it's their spirit is out there wandering. So bringing them home is like a final rest for them so that they can be finally we are at home. Cemeteries have come to being later, and their existence, it's believed that they have been there for the homeless people. Cemeteries are believed to be for people, outcasts or unidentified bodies that the towns or cities decide to bury people in cemeteries. So it's not a good thing in terms of culture for one to be buried in cemetery. And then maybe another culture believe that those who die at war, the Samburu tribe of Kenya, they don't take the bodies from the site of death. So they were fighting and then the soldiers died there. They're just left there. So that's their culture. Mm-hmm. And it surprised me when I learned about it. There's a ceremony before. Maybe these people who lived long life, I have my uncle who died 2 days ago, he's lived up to 120 years. So that's a celebration. So people are going to come together, celebrate the life of this person. Instead of mourning, they will be celebrating. And all the neighbors or other people who come to bereave the family, they will bring food. And the community is the one that cooks food. The family of the bereaved, they don't get to do anything. So the community does all the work, cooking, planning, and organizing. Then you eat together. Everyone is coming in. They get to get food. On the day of the burial, we have people coming from all over the community, relatives and friends. Then we have people speaking. These are the family who are related to this. These were the friends. We need them to say something about the dead person. Then, like, around 3, then we are laying the body to rest. This tradition that your grandchild is the one, the first one to bury you. So they'll be the first one to throw the soil into the grave, yeah. And that grandchild has to be the male, first male grandchild. And after the burial, they get a goat for doing that ceremony. In the 1800s, they never used to have coffins. So what I'm going to say is a story from my grandma. I didn't see this happening. They used to have a special blanket for that person and a cow skin. So there was a special skin that was made for burial, so they could wrap the body in that special blanket that maybe their loved ones liked to use. Then they will wrap again on the hide or skin of the animal. Then the person will be buried in that. That was like in the 1800s, during my grandma's, when my grandma was growing up. But while growing up, I see everyone is putting a coffin. They have the white linen, usually. Then their clothes will be put on the sides of the coffin. Like all of their clothes. Oh. Unless you had those that you want to keep. Like now, I kept a headscarf of my grandma for several years. And I didn't want to wash it because it reminded of me of her all the time. Mm-hmm. So if you have something special you want to keep from her, usually we put them there. And then some of them, if they are not dressed in the white linen, they are dressed in their favorite dress or cloth or suit. So they have that and the rest of the clothes go inside. They go with them. My grandma, we removed all the buttons from the clothes. Yeah, they said they should not be buried with metal. We took those out. when I asked why, I remember asking my mom, and she said, that's how it's done. It's something that has been passed down without reason. So I kept asking, why are we doing this? Then the answer you get, because maybe, and them they were told, that's how it's done, that's how it's done. The grave would be marked for a few days with a cross. Then after some time, the cross, like the wooden cross, will just die off. Then that place may never be identified as a graveyard. But in some people and some families, they have stones. My grandma has a stone right now and a cross. So it's in front of her, where the house used to be, because the house is not there anymore, but the stone is still there. So some people use stones, some people use crosses that are just temporary. So what happens, given that there's no stone, people usually know there is some mark or a tree that everyone, I think it goes, a story goes down the generation that keeps telling people, this is where your grandmother is, or this is where your grandfather is buried. I didn't get to meet my grandfather, but I remember where my grandmother used to show me where he was laid. So at that point, it was a farmland. But she could go and say, this radius, this is where he is. But now it's used for farming.
And if people are living, say, in a different country, say even in the United States, and they die, they'll sometimes have their want their body to be brought back?
Yes, some people want their bodies taken back, or the family will want to have them flown back. And some, it may not be the case, some will be buried here. So it usually depends on the wish of the dead person, or it's the family that sits together and decides we need to take our loved one to rest back home. Talking of that, who goes where and how they are buried, burning of bodies has never been part of our culture until today, really, especially the culture I'm speaking about and many tribes in Kenya, no cremation.
Have you been to any funerals here in the since you've been living in the United States, or seen cemeteries here?
I've been to cemeteries and I've been to one funeral.
And so what did you think of that?
People coming in and talking to the families, especially in the church or the funeral home. I thought they should be at home where they're supposed to be with their loved ones. That was kind of a contrast to what I expected, because I'm used to the body being taken home. Mm-hmm. What surprised me is how old some cemeteries are. I remember I saw one in Massachusetts in the 1500s. Mm-hmm. So I was surprised in the 1500s, people had already started having cemeteries burying their loved ones, and then looks like people are not buried at home. So I was asking the question, does it mean they don't have a connection with their houses or their homes? Talking of spirits, there is some belief that the spirit, so now I get mixed because I'm like Christian and trying to find out where Christian teachings lay and the culture. It's believed the spirit still lives around. So the idea of the spirit going to heaven is Christian. But in the traditional way, the spirit is usually within. And if you don't appease the spirit of the dead person, like you do the rituals that my grandma did not want them done afterwards, then bad things will happen to the family. So at some point, you will hear people claiming that, oh, that family is getting this calamities because they didn't appease so-and-so. So it's their loved ones who died and they didn't do the right rituals, or like do all the rituals that they're supposed to do. Mostly it's sacrificing animals to appease the spirit of the dead one.
That was Hilda McCory, a doctoral student at ISU who is from Kenya. This has been Gail Seiler bringing you some recollections about memorializing our deceased relatives from Colombia, the UK, Kenya, and New Jersey.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I have been your host, Susan Franson, bringing you KHOI's Memorial Day program. And now, let's turn back to Ames. Situated on the northwest corner of the ISU campus is a pleasantly wooded 2-acre site that is the home of one of the few active cemeteries associated with a university campus. In this next interview, Local Talk reporter Kay Puttock spoke about the cemetery and its history to Charles Strawhalter, a campus landscape architect and the ISU cemetery coordinator.
My guest is Chris Strawhacker, who's landscape designer and the cemetery coordinator of the ISU cemetery. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks.
What do you think are the most important things that people should know about the ISU cemetery? What are the rules, first of all, for, or the regulations for to be buried there?
Sure. To be eligible to be buried in the cemetery, you have to be a faculty member or a staff member at the university who has worked there for 20 years. If you're a faculty, you have to be a tenured assistant professor or higher. If you're a staff, a professional and scientific staff member, the classification is P19 or 20.
What does that mean exactly?
The classifications are essentially pay scale that's broken into a series of classifications. And so it's really the top two classifications in the in the pay grades.
And do they ever make exceptions to that?
There's a cemetery committee, so if someone who doesn't meet the requirements is interested in being buried in the cemetery, they can make a request. 20 years is a long period of time. Sometimes people might be close but haven't actually put their 20 years in. So they will make a request to the cemetery committee to waive the eligibility requirements. The committee then reviews the request and makes a determination based on that.
I understand that they're thinking about burying more people there, or cremated remains anyway. But you're running out of space in that.
The cemetery has been running out of space, as people have kind of considered it, for years. You can look back in, I think, the 80s or early 90s and find articles about the cemetery running out of space. But over time, the burials have changed. We do fewer traditional full burials now. More cremation, which take up less space. So we've been doing 10 to 15 burials a year for the last 10 years, and we really aren't out of space. It just, and many of the lots, because faculty spouses, if the faculty or a staff member is eligible, their spouse is also eligible, a lot of the lots or a lot of the burials that happen are lots that have already been assigned. Because a spouse is already interred.
Oh, I see.
So the burials that we do, we may do 15 burials a year. That doesn't mean we are opening 15 new lots every year.
Right.
So the number of lots we have really lasts a lot longer than you would expect.
So some of those lots were just already spoken for.
They've already been used, yeah. And part of the lot has already been had a burial in it. So it's just a continuation of that, that family burial. There has been consideration to other types of burial at the cemetery. A study was done to look at a columbarium that would inter ashes, and that might open it up to more, a broader group of people.
Yeah, that could maybe be a wall with niches in it.
Exactly, yeah, yes. Niches that could have others buried in it.
Now, on the website, I see that presidents have a special place to be buried. When you're driving by, you see these impressive-looking headstones. They would all be presidents because ordinary faculty members don't get those kind of headstones.
That's true. The cemetery, as you said, as you drive by, you'll see large monuments as grave markers, and those are generally in the president's area. If you are not in the president's section, it's essentially a stone marker that's just about level with the ground.
Right, so that you can run a mower over.
We can maintain. It's a lot easier to do maintenance. And then we also need to get equipment into the cemetery as additional burials happen. We need to be able to maneuver in there to dig or inter cremains. So having anything that's above ground makes it difficult to do that.
But you couldn't actually run a mower over those by looking.
No, they're not low enough that you could mow over them. You can mow up close to them.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Past presidents are all listed there who are buried there, but also various others who are notable. And some of those are quite interesting. I don't know if you can tell us a bit more about those, like Morris Fanchi.
Sure. He was a student in the early 1900s who came from China, and it said that he was a descendant of Confucius.
Right.
But he died in a car accident while he was here studying and was actually interned in the cemetery.
Because I understand he was an orphan, and there was nobody who claimed his remains.
Yeah.
And I believe it says on his marker, "Above all nations is humanity," which is the motto of the Cosmopolitan Club, of which he was past president. Do you happen to know, does the Cosmopolitan Club still exist?
I don't know that it does. I certainly haven't heard that term on campus as long as I've been on campus.
Well, it's appropriate for a person who's a descendant of Confucius, I suppose.
That's true.
And other people are Louis Pamela, well, there's so many places named after.
Yes, that's one of the things about the cemetery. As we meet with families and, to find a lot in the cemetery, we'll often walk through and they'll recognize names of whether they're the past presidents or deans of the colleges, buildings are named after or streets are named after many of the people in the cemetery. But it often will be family friends. So, Oh, sure, I remember when mom and dad used to play cards with so-and-so or the kids all got together. Or we were neighbors with these folks. And so it's sort of like a history remembrance for the people who go out to actually find a spot in the cemetery. I think one of the interesting burials in the cemetery is Tom Thompson, who was actually the first burial in the cemetery. And he was buried before the cemetery actually existed.
Passed. So it grew around him.
It was sort of, he was a member of the first graduating class at Iowa State. And he passed away while he was actually the caretaker for Old Main, which was the initial main building on campus. And he was really closely connected to the president at the time. The president, Welch, had been a mentor for Thompson while he was a student.
I see.
And so the connection was really strong. And when he passed, he was actually the caretaker for Old Main. So they found a lot of land that they could do his burial.
Yeah, at that time, it was just a lovely site by the river, or by the creek,
by the creek,
I should say.
Exactly.
Under the trees.
So in the next year, the trustees decided that a spot needed to be dedicated for the future burials of faculty. So that's sort of the initial start of the ISU cemetery.
Mm-hmm. Well, it suggests also on the website about Tom Thompson that he died, this isn't a suggestion, he did die of pneumonia, but that he might have caught pneumonia because he was working in this not very well-featured building, Old Main.
And an unheated building at the time, yeah.
Yeah. Anything else that people should know about the cemetery?
As I said before, it's an interesting place to visit and just walk through and look at names that sort of catch your eye and you realize how many of the buildings and facilities on campus are named after people. A lot of times you see a building name and you don't recognize necessarily where the building name came from, but this kind of helps connect back to the faculty and the staff that were here, decades or more ago.
Do you see many people visiting there and walking? It's just sort of a nice place to walk around anyway.
It is a nice place, and we actually see in the spring and fall during classes, we see students studying. There are often
Sort of sitting on the tombstones?
Not necessarily on the stones, but in the grass.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a fairly secluded spot, it's quiet, but it's on campus, it's still close, so you can go there and be a little bit separated from all the other activity. There are always drawing classes from the College of Design that come over and work on sketching using the tombstones and even the trees as subjects.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Chris Strawhacker.
You're welcome.
Every year, ISU holds a special Memorial Day ceremony to honor faculty, staff, and administrators who have died during the past year. The ceremony is arranged by the ISU Retiree Committee and facilitated by Geraldine Logue, Program Manager for the ISU Retirees Association. We'll hear about this carefully planned and deeply meaningful ceremony in this interview with Geraldine.
It'll be actually on Memorial Day. It's at the Iowa State Alumni Association in the Ryman Ballroom on the second floor. It starts at 9 o'clock. And we suggest folks come around 8:30-ish or so. And we're very pleased to have Collegiate Brass come and do Prelude, the opening music. And then we have a welcome. And then we actually sing one hymn together. Charles Knicker redid one song with some new words. And so those are the words that we're using. It's very nice.
Before Geraldine finishes telling us about the service, I'd like to break in with a few words from Charles Knicker describing how he and Lynn Ziegler found the music to fit the words.
I wrote a song about Green Hills residents, and which is, we now give you thanks, and the you for some people, could be a divine. It could be for just a spirit or just others. And so we came up with it. The first verse of it says, you know, we remember. We're just remembering people. And the second is the acknowledgement we grieve our loss. And the third verse was we pray for comfort and assurance. I wrote that. But Lynn was the one who comes up with the tune. So we were at her home here in Green, here in Ames, and she has the piano. We're sitting at her piano, and she had had this tune she was playing. And then it frankly just wasn't quite fitting. It wasn't just what I thought it could be. So I said, stop. But as she was playing, I said to her, wait a minute, why don't you try Bells of Iowa State? And she did. And of course, since she was the organist for the for Iowa State University and taught in the College of Music, she certainly just knew it. And she played it. And lo and behold, they just did.
This year, we are going to be remembering 139 retirees, spouses, and Curtin faculty and staff who have passed this year.
139.
Wow. It's a lot. But it's a great honor to do that. Mm-hmm. Every single name of every person who's deceased has been read. In the past, that wasn't done. We also offer family, friends, faculty, and staff members the opportunity to say a few words. We say 2 to 3 minutes. 2 years ago, we added to our regular ISU Retirees Memorial Ceremony reading the names of those folks who have passed away who had plaques on the wall of Alumni and Friends, which is outside the Alumni Center. And so this year, we're going to be remembering 56 of those individuals. This was an event that used to be done when VSHA was in place. Mm-hmm. And since that added and ended in 2014, we started doing this last year because they weren't sure what they were going to do, but we combined it. It's worked very well.
Yeah, I think it works better this
because
way.
Because I think VSHA, so many times those folks who are put their plaques on our wall ahead of time, they're usually our retirees so it kind of works. We have some mm-hmm. back and forth. So once a person dies, then there's a special little crest that is put on their little plaque to indicate that they have passed. So it's that's just a really nice opportunity to remember those mm-hmm. folks.
So people that have their names on the wall, have their plaques on the wall of the Alumni Association, mm-hmm. anyone can put their name there, whether they're dead or not, right?
Correct. And in fact, they usually encourage folks to put them out before they pass. Mm-hmm. Now, someone can do it for an individual afterwards. That's fine. Now, this is for alumni members. Yeah, and then once a person passes, there's a little crest of the campanile, which is put up in the right-hand corner. So that will indicate that that person has died.
So on Memorial Day, the new crests, basically, you'll be reading the list of the people that have had
Correct.
Their crests added.
Those who have those who have died since May of 2016, mm-hmm. okay. we'll be reading those folks. And so we just have, I think I said we have 56 of those individuals okay. to remember. The nice thing that we've been doing, instead of people having to get up and walk to the front to a microphone, we have everybody sitting at round tables so they can sit with their families. And there's so many times that a whole family will take a whole table with their grandkids. Mm-hmm. And and we love to have that. We really do. We don't care how young the kids are or if they get restless. That's okay. We don't care. It's good for the family to be there. And then what we do is my assistant and I, we each have a handheld microphone, and we go to that table. Okay. We go to them.
Yeah, that would save time, too.
Absolutely. And it saves time, and plus it lets the person stay with their family
right.
for support.
Right.
And I can tell you, the first person who talks always tears up, mm-hmm. always cries a little bit. We all tear up a little bit with them. And then from that point, everything seems to go okay. And it just kind of breaks the ice. And then there's funny stories and there's some sad stories and people laugh and they cry. And we've had so many emails and letters afterwards thanking us for mm-hmm. doing this because it means so much to
them.
It
sounds like a lovely ceremony, actually. It is. I really like the idea of the round tables. And
so, it works so nicely. And, you know, not everybody's able to attend,
mm-hmm.
and we understand that because it's right on Memorial Day. But we always, like I said, we have an option for folks to send tributes mm-hmm. and for those to be included. This year, we just have a new photographer who just came on board at the Alumni Association. So this year, we're going to be trying to add a few sound bites, possibly, and a few photos. We will not take photos of anybody who doesn't want photos taken of them, of course. And all of these different things are set up by the Aisha Retirees Association. It has a special committee called the Memorial Day Ceremony Committee. And so they work to put these things together and... In fact, usually the horticulture department will put together flower boxes, and these boxes are put at the ISU Cemetery for all of those who were buried since last year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a group of folks who will be going out there on Friday. They'll be putting a flag up along with a big pot of Gerber daisies this year.
Oh, lovely.
And then we will have a representative there at the cemetery after the ceremony to help anybody who wants to find a gravesite.
Yes.
So.
Okay.
And so we're hoping for nice weather.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Geraldine Logue. Thanks for coming in.
Oh,
welcome to An Evening with Elizabeth, and I am Elizabeth.
Elizabeth was a desirable teenager that the Statler brothers sang about, the mythical host of Evening with Elizabeth, the show that airs on KHOI every Sunday at 7 p.m. However, the real host of the show, who created this beautiful illusion for us, was B.J. Kearns, a resident of Kelly, Iowa. She joined KHOI as the station went on the air in 2012 and created one of the first and longest running shows on our radio station. This is Ursula Rudenberg, KHOI station manager. I'm here with Elizabeth's editor, Cynthia McClure.
We're sad to announce that B.J. Kearns has passed away.
B.J. died on the evening of Thursday, May 25th at Green Hills here in Ames. There is a memorial service, which will be on Wednesday, May 31st. You're invited to join. It's a public ceremony. There'll be visitation from 1 until 2 on Wednesday, the 31st of May. There'll be a mass service after that for BJ, and that will be held at St. Cecilia's Church here in Ames. I had a few moments to speak with BJ's sister, who graciously agreed to an interview. So I wanted to share this with you just so that we all can know a little bit about who Elizabeth was. Marianne Gardner, thank you for speaking to us at this time of sorrow. Tell us a little bit about who BJ was, especially for those people that have really enjoyed her radio show.
Happy to do it. I know it was a very special part of her life in the last few years. It meant a lot to her.
Well, we were very lucky to have those last few years of her life, and she was very, very talented. She really approached the radio show as an art. She understood what radio was, probably grew up listening to it. She called herself Elizabeth, and in fact, she didn't tell people that she was Elizabeth because she didn't want to break the illusion of whoever people saw in their mind as Elizabeth being. She wanted to leave that image intact and not interfere.
Right. I think, and everything that she was doing there was so totally different from anything that she had done in her life. So any of us that knew her had never seen that part of her.
Had she ever done any art before of any sort?
No. she was always the athletic and the sports-minded person and animals around and everything.
So where did BJ grow up?
We were both born in little town of Anamosa, Iowa. Our dad was extension director over there. And then from then on, we kind of just moved all across Iowa. Then my dad left extension and went into farming, and we moved every other March 1st all across Iowa. And then we ended up down at Collins, Iowa, and went to high school down there. There were just the two of us in the family.
And how would you characterize BJ as your sister when you were young?
She was ornery, vivacious, and she was just fun. She was just what we called a towhead at the time, just kinky, curly, blonde curls, you know, and just that mischievous. She loved playing games and just being mysterious and wild imagination. We'd lay in bed at night, and she'd make up these preposterous stories, you know, and just go on and on until she just would have us all in stitches. And we generally lived in the big old two-story farmhouses, you know, big old square houses, and our bedrooms were always upstairs. And she'd invariably go upstairs first at night and shut off all the lights and then jump out and scare me. And we went to the little high school at Collins. She was in sports a lot. The only sport available to girls at that time was the six-on-six basketball. And here she is at 4'10 to 4'11, jumping high as the sky, you know, and run like a deer. And she was one of the top basketball players in the area. You know, she could jump up and guard those tall forwards like nothing, and she just loved it. And she loved to run, but of course we didn't have any track activities or anything. She just take off out in the field and just run like a, again, like a stallion or something. She just loved to run, and she had a long, long, thick ponytail. So that old ponytail would go swinging and flying behind her. It's like she was free when she would run. She just loved it. She was tiny but mighty.
Were you aware that she liked music?
I know she did, but I did not know that she went that deeply into it and with the research and everything, because we had a lot of music at home. That was just part of our family, you know. Well, we both took piano lessons, and she played the accordion, and she was in the high school band and in the chorus. That was just a big part of our family, and so music was always a big part, and she was totally fascinated as a youngster, even with the movies. And musicals were good back in those days, and she's always had that kind of a fascination for it.
And when she went to Iowa State?
She got her degree in leisure services. I think she was wanting to go into things like coaching and so forth like that. While she was at Iowa State, she played bell lyre, if you know what that is, in the marching band.
I do. She spoke to me about that and described how at the time when she was in the marching band at Iowa State, it was called an all-male band.
It was.
They didn't acknowledge that there were women playing the bells in the band. And during rehearsals, they were never told any instructions. So they were essentially treated like they didn't exist, and they had to just figure out on their own where to be and stand and march, and they were expected to play the bells, but they were not allowed to expect to be acknowledged. This is a story that I think all of us who grew up from the 50s on back do understand. They were always kind of ghosts in the machine, in a sense. They were trying to figure out how to participate without anybody really overtly acknowledging that they did exist.
And she continued with that alumni band. They have an alumni marching band. She continued in that for years and years. And,
that's right.
And after she became ill and could hardly carry those big old heavy metal bells, and she was out there playing with the alumni band.
And she also told me that she did play basketball in college, but it was not really a full-blown competitive sport, and she wanted to compete.
Exactly. Very much so. Very much so. But she did go back and finish her master's degree. It was in ag education, animal science, and journalism. That was a rough time for her getting that, because about the time then she finished up with her master's degree, she was finally diagnosed with lupus. And nobody really knew how ill she was with that. But she couldn't really find a job then because of her illness. At some point then she needed some income, so she was working at McFarland Clinic for a while, just in the evening, you know, cleaning up and everything. And then she was able to get on with the little consumer shopper paper in Kelly. She was an account executive, and she did that for many, many years.
And she lived in Kelly.
She lived in Kelly. She had her own house down there in Kelly.
It must have been hard for her to become ill because she was so athletic.
Exactly. And she wasn't one to complain or let people know that she wasn't well.
So in the last few years of her life, when she was here at KHOI, was she actually ill?
Oh, yes.
Nobody here knew that.
I know. I mean, this was like in the 70s when she was diagnosed. And lupus is a really hard-to-diagnose disease. And so for many, many years, and she was on prednisone, and then now they realize she shouldn't have had that. So what it did was destroyed the bones and the joints in her shoulders. So I don't know how she ever even drove, but so you notice that way. She used to have beautiful, beautiful, long, fluffy, curly hair. And, you know, she couldn't even, she had to get a real long comb to get up because she couldn't get her arms up to do her hair.
Wow.
It's very painful, very painful.
But, you know, she would come to the station and she would have milk crates full of a vinyl.
I know.
And she would carry those into this. I mean, my last memory of BJ is watching her carry these crates of vinyl into the radio station. And it never would have occurred to me that she was in pain. She was very, very independent and always was dressed. I don't think saying that BJ was dressed impeccably quite says it. BJ was always dressed to the season in outfits where everything was meaningful.
Oh, yes.
From the shoes to the socks to what she had in her hair.
Yes, the rings and the watches and the bracelets. And
BJ was a person here at the station who always pulled her weight around here. She cleaned the refrigerator and she decorated the station. We were always decorated seasonally.
Our mother was that way. She, Betty Jane, would take tubs over to Mom's and decorate the nursing home. And then the day that the holiday was over or the season was over, she'd take that back and carry a new tub in. She kind of just decided, well, she would do it with you, too, where she could decorate instead of doing it like her mom wanted it. So she could decorate yours like she wanted.
That first day of spring, we'd come in and there would be bobblehead chicks sitting on the edge of the broadcast studio window. For those who were her fans, what did she say about the radio show? What did it mean to her?
She was never married. She never had children of her own. The radio show was hers. So even though she didn't brag about it, it was so important to her. But, you know, for somebody to have that much and to want to share that much, because I see the pieces of paper that she had in there with her handwritten script. So all these handwritten scripts and then the reams of paper that she has researching all of the musicians, the composers, the artists, the styles of music, I mean, just that she went into all the research and the sharing of this, because it's like archiving everything that's there, because the young people don't know what music is like today.
And BJ, in many ways, was very much a woman of her time. She was very courageous, and I think the word would be determined.
And it's not easy to be a single person in today's society.
That's right.
And I admire her for that.
Was her death a surprise to you, or was this something that those who knew that she was ill saw coming?
I knew she was ill, and the lupus had taken its toll on the kidneys. When she went in the 1st of April with the heart attack, she just never came back from that, and she went very quickly and very peacefully. She was at peace and ready to go that night. And I talked to her about 7:30 that night. Her voice had that little perky sound, and it was clear. She was just all perky, and we chatted a little bit, and I said, I'll see you in the morning. And she says, okay. And she called the nurses about 10:15, and about 10 minutes later, she just slept away very peacefully, so she deserved that.
Is her funeral service open to the public?
Oh, yes, certainly, yes. So we would be happy for any of the people that listen to her to come, and so we can meet them and share.
So again, the visitation is on Wednesday, May 31st, from 1 until 2, and after that will be the Mass for BJ. That will be at St. Cecilia's Church here in Ames.
Correct.
And I've been speaking with Mary Ann Gardner, sister of BJ Kearns, who was Elizabeth. Thank you, Mary Ann, for spending this time with us.
I just want to say thank you for giving her an important purpose in life and sharing her talents so people could see a side of her that hadn't been able to come out before. So we appreciate all of your support and concern.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that was Mary Ann Gardner, BJ Kearns' sister in Nevada. This is Ursula Rudenberg, station manager of KHOI, and I'm here with Cynthia McClure, who was BJ Kearns' editor. All of us who were at the station any length of time were very familiar with the image of BJ right here in the studio where we're sitting now, spending upwards of 6 hours at a time in here, and she would have all of her paperwork spread out on the table. And if you had to come into the studio for any reason, you definitely felt like you were walking into to her domain. Over there, she would have dinner and
yep.
lunch cooked and spread out
yep.
on the table. And she would be working relentlessly
yeah.
and on this computer to put these shows together. Yeah.
She was very specific on what she wanted done. Every single show was very personal. And she was meticulous in what she did.
Mm-hmm.
She always came here well-equipped, prepared. She was tenacious. She was a tiny person, but she had that solid character. Like, she wasn't afraid of hard work. You know, it would be snowing, and she would come in, and she would just make things happen.
Tremendous amount of thought and work
yeah.
and preparation went into these shows.
Yeah, and especially in our early days, we had just very minimal equipment, and she would relentlessly try to figure out the technology to make it happen. Significant.
It was a significant commitment. By the time she died, she was beginning to edit her own shows.
Oh, yeah.
That was to a large extent due to your instruction, along with John Bassert and
yep.
Steve Weiler and a number of other people who
yeah,
spent
a lot of
time
people.
Helping
a
BJ.
Yeah, a lot of people have worked with her over the years. I just happened to be the last one that she worked with.
And we all had the VJ experience of her walking out of the studio and saying, the sound files have disappeared. Right?
Yeah, there were a few times and I would just have to go, you know, undo, undo, undo and find them.
The sound files have disappeared.
Yeah, she'd push the wrong button or get something wrong. So it would be like, she didn't complain at all, not a bit. And I think she liked sharing her music. And I let her know how much I liked listening to it. It's like it's the music that you don't hear on the radio anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to keep her show going.
And we're going to keep the music going.
Yep.
Both shows that BJ Kearns produced will continue on KHOI. They both air on Sunday. Polka Time is from 6 until 6:30, and Evening with Elizabeth is 7 until 8 p.m., both on Sunday. So again, thank you for the music, BJ. Thank you for being with us. Everybody matters here at KHOI. Everybody matters in our community. And BJ Kearns continues to matter to us. This is Ursula Rudenberg. And now let's let BJ have the last word. Here is the standard way that BJ ended her show, Evening with Elizabeth.
Thank you for tuning in to hear An Evening with Elizabeth, and I am Elizabeth on KHOI 89.1 FM, your Heart of Iowa Community Radio. Be good, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite, and good night. Let's go see that sunset, Oldsmobile.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I, Susan Franson, have been your host for today. Other voices you heard were Marcia Miller, Gail Seiler, Hilda McCory, Kay Puttock, Charles Strahalter, Geraldyn Loeb, Charles Knicker, Ursula Rudenberg, B.J. Kearns, Marianne Gardner, and Cynthia McClure. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was The Bells of Iowa State and Elizabeth by the Sadler Brothers. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come in and join the Local Talk team. We've made a change in our morning schedule. Until now, Democracy Now! Was aired
on KHOI only at 6 p.m. weekday evening. We are now airing it in the morning from 8 to 9 a.m., right after local talk. Morning Masterpieces will return to the air at 9 a.m. for a one-hour rather than two-hour slot. We have made this change in light of the rapidly changing events on the national news. We want to provide you with the latest news in the most timely fashion possible. Let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878. Email us at khoi@gmail.com or go to the contact page of khoifm.org. So stay tuned for Democracy Now! With headline news at the top of the hour. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.